understand our world. So really, you open up a Chumash, and you open up a Gemara, and we wonder, like, what's the connection? Manashem says, trust me, you're going to see the connection. You're going to see the connection. The time will come. So if we really don't know, if we're really under hypnosis, and we have no idea what's going on in this world, so what's the point? Why is the Kadosh Baruch Hu fooling us? And the answer is, he's not fooling us. But these are our nesiyonos. These are the range of our nesiyonos. I've often said, I read a story once. It's a great story. Two paratroopers jumped off a plane. They were supposed to land behind enemy lines, and they landed in a swamp. And one of them said, intelligence had it all wrong. We're supposed to land in a village. We're in a swamp. I'm sitting down to write out a report. And he said, you're also sinking into quicksand, and the Germans are coming. So you could write your report and die. I'm moving on. But we're in a swamp. Okay, this is where we are. So Kadosh Baruch Hu says, I need you to work out of the theater of where I put you. And I need your perception of what's going on in the world. You want to know what's going on in the world? You have no idea what's going on in the world. Do we know what's changing in this world? You know, I read today a piece by somebody who said that how long can America last? How long can the United States last? He was making an equation. He was drawing a parody with the Roman Empire. And he said that the Roman Empire went through a megepha. And afterwards, there was a tremendous breakup in the society between the difference in the rich and poor. And he shows that over a course of 100 years, that was the undoing of the Roman Empire that was supposed to last forever. And he draws parody and he draws an analogy between the two. And it was very scary, and I was reading it. But I said to myself, you know, America shall last forever, right, till Mashiach comes. But no country ever lasted forever. Are we witnessing a breakup now in the very fabric of our society? Where did the Rabbeinu Shlomo put us over here? And the answer is, the Rabbeinu Shlomo says, I know exactly where you are. You're on a bridge. You're going from one place to the other. Just do what you have to at this given point. So I was once in a hospital. My father wasn't well. And I was in an elevator, and there was an older woman there. She looked at me and said, are you a rabbi? I hate when people do that. She goes, are you a rabbi? I said, depends for what? If you want to give me shlachmanis, yeah, I'm a rabbi. I'm not really a rabbi, but if you want, how can I help you? She goes, my daughter became a balas tshuva. Uh-oh, she's not going to blame me. She got married, and she and her husband were in a terrible accident in Eretz Yisrael. Her husband died, and now she's here. It was in Cornell, and she's going through multiple surgeries on her brain. She looked at me like she was angry at God, and I was saying, I hear it. I'm just in the elevator, I don't know. She goes, well, can you go talk to her? So I said to myself, I should go talk to her. What exactly should I say to her? And I said, Rabbi Hashem put me in this elevator. He said I should go talk to her. So if he said I should go talk to her, then I have to go talk to her. So I went to talk to her, and we sat down, and we had a whole discussion. And she said to me, thanks for coming to visit. No one really knows I'm here. So I said, there's a lot of Birkei Chaylim organizations that, we can get you food and people to visit you. She says, she's okay. And she says to me, the doctors were just here, the neurosurgeons. And they said, I really need neurosurgery because there's bleeding in my brain. And I'm like, yeah, I'm all of like 25 years old. And she says to me, the doctors aren't sure because the problem is near my optic nerves. And there was also a possibility of a tumor that they had. And there was a benign tumor that they had discovered in the course of her x-rays, that after I go through the next surgery, she said, Rahman al-Islam, I may not be able to see.
Meaning to say that
he was... And I'm listening to this, and I said, I can't believe it. I'm worried about what? And she says, I'm really worried. So in what was an absolute genius of a question, I said, really? Her name was Tova. Tova, so why are you worried? I think back how ingenious that question was. But this is what she told me. She said, I've been in hospitals in and out for weeks and weeks. And the problem with hospitals is just, there's no day, there's no night. It's just the rotation, the 12-hour shifts of nurses. If not for the shift of nurses, I wouldn't know it's day or night. Go ahead. And she goes ahead and she says, what I really live for is Shabbos. I don't have much of a Shabbos. Like, what kind of a Shabbos could you have in a hospital? But what I have is they come and they have this little tray and they cover it with a little tablecloth. Apparently one of her friends brings it to her, and she can't light lech, but they put two little bulbs and a chal and a grape juice. She can't even eat or drink. But I look at it, and I see the zmirais on the table, and I just close my eyes, and I'm in Shabbos. I'm in a different world. And she turns to me, and she has a tear in her eye, and she says, but if I won't be able to see, how will I know it's Shabbos? And I'm walking out of there and I'm saying, no, this can't be. This can't be real. That's what she's worried about. How am I going to know that it's Shabbos? Anyway, it was Purim, and I came and I read the Megillah for her, and my wife came by, and my kids came by. And after a while, we came around. It was after her surgery. It took a while. She was totally out of it. And then I met her mother again in the elevator. She said, I want you to go upstairs and please speak to Tova. And her mother says to me, she can't see. And I'm like, my feet turn into jelly and you start sweating. I wasn't used to it yet. I was younger and I went up the elevator and I walked in there. And what a person looks like after brain surgery, you don't want to know. And we sit down and I don't know what gave me the wherewithal to say this. I said, Tova, you're going to see Shabbos. I'm telling you, you're going to see Shabbos. And she smiled. Why did I say it? I don't know. Maybe about Ruach HaKodesh? Nope. I don't know why, because I didn't have what to say. So I said it, and I walked out. I said, God, don't embarrass me. I have nothing else to say. Anyway, fast forward about 6 weeks later, I'm walking on the street, and someone calls me. And I turn around, and it's Tova. She's walking on the street. Someone's helping her, and she says the doctors can't understand it. After 2 weeks, she started to see. I'm not saying she's ready to drive in the Indy 500. She didn't see perfectly. She may have been legally blind, but she was able to see. She was able to walk on the street. And she said to me, can I see Shabbos in your house? It took me a while to register. I'm a little slow on the pickup. I said, of course, Tova. And she was our guest. She was our guest for a while. But what was her inner drive? What's the koyach of a yid? To see Shabbos. You know what Shabbos is? Shabbos is an end of la'asid lavai. Shabbos is, after 120, we're going to leave this world and we're going to see, oh, it all makes sense. It all makes sense. We were down here under hypnosis, but this is where I had to go in order for me to accomplish what I had to. So we're stuck in the middle. Down here, we're on a bridge. I'll tell you an interesting thing. I've learned over the years to be very careful, especially when I'm speaking to an audience. And you got to be very careful with political humor. With every humor, you have to be careful. You don't hurt anybody. Most jokes I don't use. You know, that for a joke to be a good joke and not to be litzanis, it has to meet three criteria. That it's totally clean, that you don't hurt anybody, and that you feel you're going to make people happy with this, not the other way around. That eliminates 99.99% of all jokes. But Al-Kopan of Damish still see gives you, especially if you yourself are just one big joke, so you kind of, generates more. But I remember once I was in a place, and I made this, especially political jokes you want to stay away from. But President Trump had just been elected, and I had made this. It wasn't a joke. It wasn't a bad joke. It was like a little bit. It was a pro-Trump kind of a joke. And this person came over to me and said, it was in the crowd. It goes, you Jews. That person was also a Yid. I don't know. You Hasidic Jews. That's all. You don't care for the people. How could you say a pro-Trump thing? You don't care for all the pain that he's causing for everyone. I was like, whoa. Take it easy. Relax. It was just a joke. So I was in a different place. I was in a hotel someplace. And I made an anti-Trump joke, but like a episode, a little bit, making fun of Trump a drop. Maybe he wasn't supposed to. And this guy comes over to me. He was wearing a small yarmulke, blonde hair combed to the side, and goes, oh, you Hasidim don't like Trump, right? You don't care for America, right? I was like, oh my goodness. Us Hasidim, we have a problem on both sides. You understand? It's like whatever's going to happen, if Trump wins or loses, it's going to be our fault. And I said, this is the story of the Yidden in the diaspora. This is the story of us. We're on a bridge. Stay away. You know the famous story of the mashal that they say that the lion was very hungry. Everybody was starving to death. So the lion called over the sheep and said, tell me something. Do I have bad breath? Sometimes if you don't eat for a while, you have bad breath. So the sheep said, no, your majesty, you don't have bad breath. He goes, lying to a king? He eats the sheep for supper, which is, of course, an excuse. He just wanted an excuse to eat him for supper. Then the next day, he calls over the goat and says, do I have bad breath? So he says, so what happened to the sheep? He goes, yeah. Chutzpah, you say the king has bad breath. He eats him. And he calls over the fox. He says, do I have bad breath? And the fox says, sorry, I can't smell. I have coronavirus. I can't smell. Whatever. I can't smell. I don't know. I wouldn't know if you have bad breath or not. He says, what we have to do in Gaulis is we don't know. Stay away from it. But I think it emphasizes a little bit of where we are. History is constantly being written and rewritten. What's the MS and what's the Sheker? We'll never know down here in this world. People have agendas, and then they write the news based on that agenda. The famous story, I'm sure President Trump would love this story, talking about not making President Trump jokes, but he's busy with the fake news. And the Herschel is the news reporter for the town. In those days, they didn't have CNN, they didn't have MSNBC, they didn't have, you know, they had didn't have WhatsApp. They had, you know, this guy would go to the big town. He would come back, sit by the mikveh, sit in the barbershop, give over the news. So Herschel goes to Wien, and he sits there in the big city, and he comes back to the little shtetl, and he tells them the news. And Herschel tells everyone, you think I tell them the truth? I lie through my teeth. But I tell them the stories I need them to hear, that it's good for me. So somebody once said to him, he goes, so why do you bother going to Wien for? Why don't you just stay here and make up the story? He goes, I have to find out what the real story is, because I have to make sure not to say the real story. If I don't go to Wien, for all I know, the story I'm making up is the truth. I don't want to say the truth. So I have to go to Wien to find out what the story is to make sure I'm lying. Okay. But history also repeats itself. And Yidden were always on the bridge in the middle. Yidden were accused of being the Bolsheviks, and they were accused of being the Mensheviks. They were accused of being the communists and the anti-communists. We were throughout, right up until Germany and World War I, right? They were the patriotic, and the Germans said, you were the traitors. Stay away. We're on a bridge. We're going to come back to where we started from. We just have to make it through the bridge. It's not kedai to get involved with anyone on the bridge. You're soon going to be off the bridge. That's what this life is. It is a bridge. So isn't it amazing? Stocks today went up, and they're actually, I read, back to where they were before this whole balagan started, which doesn't make any sense whatsoever, but that's where they are. See, of course, if you would have invested when we were at the bottom of the V, right? If I would have, could have. Isn't that amazing?
I think you're back to where they were. Investing gems now.
I think the world is back to where it's supposed to be.
Investing gems.
I think Rabbi Shem is telling us, trust me. Whatever the crisis is, how low you're going, you're going to come back to where you were. Don't worry about it. Another person that said he's on a date and he wants to impress the chant cooker for him. So he says, you know, my grandfather lost everything in the Great Depression. Really? Yes. So she thought, well, his grandfather used to be very wealthy. He lost everything in the Great Depression. Oh, his grandfather, she tells her mother, he must have had big buildings. You know, he lost everything in the Great Depression, but they have it in their blood. After they got married, she said to him, what do you mean your grandfather lost everything in the Great Depression? She found that his grandfather was a Ben Shlemazel. So he said, my grandfather had this push cart. He sold like bananas. And when this rich guy committed suicide, he jumped off the 10th floor and fell onto the push cart. So my grandfather lost everything in the Great Depression. But it's true. Grandfather lost everything in the Great Depression, right? We're here, Rabbi Sai, to pick up the pieces. So in this week's parasha, we have a very interesting phenomenon. So there's a nun hafucha. Wait, what's a nun hafucha? There's a backwards nun on both sides. And according to Gemara Darshan's, that is really, in certain ways, is really seven chamashim. Hibin Sayorin is a chumash on its own. What is the basis of this nun hafucha? Even when it was time for the Yidden to move, the Anani HaKavod rolled up, and Moshe Rabbeinu said, go, but don't go too fast, wait for us. What's this all about? And then they had to stop, and of course they never knew when they're going and when they had to stop. They never knew when, but Klal Yisrael just had to say, Rabbi Shem, whenever you tell us to go, we're going to go. Whenever you tell us to stop, sometimes they wanted to go, they were itching to go, and they had to wait, and sometimes they were itching to stay, and they had to go. Which is what life is all about. That's the Vahiban Soya Arain V'yayim HaShem. And if a person commits himself to believing that wherever you are is where you're supposed to be, and if the Divine Hashem says go, you go. If the Divine Hashem says stay, you stay, even though it's not necessarily where you would like to be, then you're Zaycha to the Bracha of Kuma HaShem V'yafutzu Aivecha. But there's the Sefer HaChaim from the brother of the Maral. He says a fascinating thing. We've often said, I'm in my show and tell mode, I don't know why, because I'm in the school here, a Cheder. Why is a Tzaddik called a Tzaddik? A Tzaddik is called a Tzaddik because a tzaddik carries a yid on its shoulders. That's why if you carry a yid on your shoulder, then you're called a tzaddik. That's why a tzaddik is, I don't know if it's coming out here. That's why a tzaddik is called a tzaddik, because a tzaddik carries a yid, right, on its shoulders. So why not an aleph? An aleph also carries a yud on its shoulders. And the answer is, yes, an aleph also carries a yud on its shoulders. But the aleph does so, I think I'm trying to get out of the light. But the aleph does so at the expense of another yud at the bottom. The aleph is carrying a yud on the shoulders, but the aleph does so. So the brother of the Maral says a fascinating thing, okay? really, what is a tzaddik? A tzaddik is a nun hafucha. Tzaddik is a nun, right? Look at this way. It's a nun. My coordination is not that great. In kindergarten, my motor skills were like, I need therapy. So I'll try to get my finger over here. A tzaddik is really a nun. It's a nun hafucha. And there's a yud on top of a nun. Because what is a yid? You fall. You're a nun. Nefila means to fall, right? In Ashrei, the Gemara says, "Mesechtes brachos." There's no nun because it represents nafla. Like come to write psulas Yisrael. David HaMelech avoided the nun. The nun represents nefila, and I can't even fall straight. And the yid rises above it, and that's the symbol of the nun hafucha between the two lehib and tzoya aren. So while we're on our now, wherever we are, we may not be where we want to be. Okay, you don't have to be where you want to be. So there's some cypress as a dover pella. When the Yidden were traveling, it was rough on them. It's rough to travel in a midbar with 600,000 people. I don't know if they had to do social distancing or not, but the Shvatim had to maintain the position, right? The Shvatim had to be where they were. And they had to travel with the flags, carrying the Mishkan and carrying everything with their kids and walking through a desert. It wasn't easy. Right, one of the Mesonim of this week's parasha, Rashi says, because they went 3 days without stopping, they were so angry, they were complaining. But really, as they were traveling, they were getting close to the Eretz Yisrael. We want to rest. Oh, when they rested, everything stopped. The Anani Yakovit spread out, big, beautiful umbrella over them, and the Mishkan was set up. When you were resting, you were actually further away from Eretz Yisrael. Right, when you were traveling, you were close to the Eretz Yisrael. So says the Chassam Sofer, a Dover Pella. He says in life, the time that we're muching ourselves, that we're traveling from one place to another, we're not sure of ourselves. That's when we're getting closer to Eretz Yisrael. Those moments that we have menuchas and nefesh, you're actually further. Reb Heschel Zatchev used to say like this, that the word shmeichel means to smile in Yiddish. That shmeichel is Rosh Etevois, kulam yil mishibadim lavidasa yizbarach shemoi. Again, I'm still, right? So the word shmeichel, that must have had a very boring day, you're thinking, right? So the word shmeichel is, right? This is how you spell Shmeichel, right? To smile. So kulam yim mishibadim lavidasa yizbarach shemoi. If you want to scramble it, so they told Reb Heschel Zatchev, yeah, but it's not in order. It's not in order. It's not, you know, so he says that's when you shmeichel. When things aren't in order, they're not working out the way you thought. I thought for sure I'm becoming a chassan. I didn't. I thought for sure by now I'll be back in school. I thought for sure I'm going to graduate. I thought before this, and it doesn't work out, and you're still smiling, that's when you smile in life. But if you want everything to fall into place exactly the way you want, then there's taka. Then there is taka. No shmeichel. That's where we are. So, where am I here? Okay. There's a fascinating story. This is a very good book. Recommended. It's from Nachman Seltzer, a man of Yerushalayim. He has a lot of fascinating stories. He's a 10th generation Yerushalmi, and he has here an absolutely, I thought, one of many fascinating stories. This Rabbi Yisrael says that when he grew up, his parents grew up in Neisharim. And when they, it just shows you how society changed. They used to be much more integrated with the Arabs before the state of Israel. And Akadei Kach, when his parents, who were many generations Yerushalmi, if they wanted to say something, that, right, your parents had a language between themselves, they didn't want you to understand, right? And my parents used to speak Polish that I wasn't supposed to understand. And most of my friends, the parents spoke Hungarian. So they used to speak Arabic. Even though they were Yerushalmis, they used to speak Arabic. And so he was so frustrated that when his parents wanted to say something amongst themselves, they didn't want the kids to hear, they would speak Arabic, that he wandered around the shuk enough that he picked up Arabic. And he worked on it. And he actually had a Arabic. Maybe it wasn't the most professional Arabic, but he had an Arabic. So he said that when he was drafted into the Israeli army, they asked him what language he speaks. So he said, Yiddish, you know, Ivrit, and Arabic. And they looked at him, Meir Sharm kid, Arabic. So he told them why he speaks Arabic. So they tested him. They said, good, you're working for the intelligence and you're going to translate documents. So he said, I don't know how to read Arabic. So he said, good, we have another guy who knows how to read who doesn't know how to talk. So the two of you are going to get together. Okay? So he writes there a fascinating story. He says, in 1990, Saddam Hussein attacks Kuwait. We thought that was the end of the world then, if you remember. And Saddam Hussein had given orders to his general, who was the minister of the interior and was also his brother-in-law. Sheer coincidence, it was also happened to be his brother-in-law. And he said to bomb the main shul in Baghdad, Rahman al-Islam. So Saddam's brother-in-law was given the command to bomb the main shul in Baghdad, first went over to the shul, and he figured, what could I help myself to before I bomb it? And he took out the Sifrei Torah. And the reason he took out the Sifrei Torah was not al-Tzahava Satoira, but he figured that he'll be able to sell it on the black market and make some American dollars, which so he took out all the Sefer Torah and he hid them someplace. He hid them actually in a cave. Then Saddam lost the war, and he rescinded the order of destroying the Beis HaKnesses. Now his brother-in-law had a problem, because how does he get the Sefer Torah back into the shul? If he says that he took out the Sefer Torah to try to sell them, then his brother-in-law may kill him. No fight like a family fight, you know what I mean? On the other hand, so he was in trouble, so he didn't know what to do, so the Sefer Torah stayed in the cave. So this person writes, Yisrael Gellis writes, that when the Israelis made a peace treaty with Jordan, he went to Jordan, and he wanted to, just so that God's sense of humor, you know, Chassidus HaBekasha, yeah? He figured if he makes it in Jordan, and Muhammad and Abdul make it, it'll be much cheaper. He'll be able to sell it in Mea Sharm for a lot more money. Then he had a whole plan, they should make Shtreimlach. They had a whole plan. So he's going to Jordan, okay? Next step was Saudi Arabia. But he's going to Jordan to make a Bekasha, all right? This is what he's going to Jordan for. And he had a whole deal with the guy, and he teaches him, he's showing him how to make a Bekasha. Make sure you make it right over left. You know how to button it. Yeah, he's a shrine. We'll make it, you know what I mean? We're going to make some money over here. You're going to sell a lot cheaper. And the guy tells him, okay, you know, he's $50 a Bekasha. He makes two samples. He says, come, let's have some coffee. And he calls him into the back room behind the curtain, his friend in Jordan. And he says, I want to show you something. He takes him, and he shows him a Sefer Torah. One of the particular Sefer Torah they took out, and they, Rahman al-Islam, cut it up in pieces. And he blew up. He said, how dare you do this? And he storms out. He says, the deal's off. I'm not doing the Bekashas with you. And the guy was very upset because he lost the business. He said, no, it was just this one thing. We were just angry one day. We did it. So he comes home, and he calls his contacts in the Mossad, and he says, you know, they have these Sefer Torah in Jordan. He thinks they were stolen during the War of Independence. So the Mossad told him, because they were his friends. No, he said, we're tracking these Sefer Torah. They were in a cave. They're from Iraq, from the main shul in Baghdad. And, you know, this brother-in-law, Saddam's brother-in-law, could be his brother-in-law, son-in-law, his aide, someone over there knows it's there. He's trying to figure out how he can sell it, you know what I mean? Because he couldn't exactly walk into the cipher on Avenue J with it, you know? So where else do you sell it? And in Iraq itself, I don't know if Sefer Torah people are willing to spend that kind of money on it. So Al-Kopanim, they smuggled some to Jordan, and they're trying to sell it. We know about it. And he said, you know, now we have to have a whole plan to smuggle them in from Iraq. And they did. They put them into big tires of tractors. He writes a whole story. And they smuggled them into Yerushalayim, into Jordan, and from Jordan back into Eretz Yisrael. So he writes that he took these Sefer Torah, which was Iraqi Sefer Torah from way back, brought one to Rebbe Yashiv. Rebbe Yashiv was studying the Ksav. He was like, for a long time, he was studying the Ksav. It was a little bit different. It's the Arizal Ksav. He was like, he brought it to the Vision Tzer Rebbe. The Vision Rebbe started to cry. He brought it to Rav Elio, the Rav Harashi. He's an Iraqi. He knew exactly who the cipher was. And then he writes a whole story that amongst these Sefer Torah was actually the Sefer Torah of the Ben Ish Chai. And he writes a whole story how he insisted on seeing it and they were hiding it. I'm just fascinated by it. Saddam Hussein says, I am going to destroy this Beis HaMedrash. Hashem says, oh, let me take the Sefer Torah out and send it to Israel. Think about this hashgacha. How long they were laying in a cave. That Beis Medrash was probably ransacked 10,000 times, especially after Saddam left. When Saddam was there was some stability. After Saddam left, between the war between the Sunnis and the, you know, you can imagine what would have been with that Sefer Torah. There aren't too many Yidden in Iraq. There's social distancing between the Yidden in Iraq right now. But Hashem said, this Sefer Torah, the Ben Ish Chai Sefer Torah, is going to make it to Eretz Yisrael. We're going to be back. Don't worry. The Ribbono Shel Olam knows how to preserve us. Every Yid is a Sefer Torah. Why we have to be on this bridge? We're on the bridge. Just remember, it's a bridge. There's a king, a marshal of Sfarim, said a king comes to visit, I know, a peasant in the woods. And the peasant gets rid of all his wooden kalim, and he borrows gold kalim from the pirates. And the king comes in, he goes, no, I wanted one meal with a wooden kalim. What are you doing? So in Tav Shin Pei, can't believe the year is over, and this is how it's ending. We all had our Nesiyonos. And my Nesiyon is different, and your Nesiyon is different.
No,
doesn't seem to be over yet. Emshe should protect us all. But again, what your plans were as a junior, were you graduating? Are you in the middle of smicha? You're a Torah in a cave. And it's all connected. The Rabbi Nishlan has a cheshbon. I remember listening to the news once, and they were saying how there's a problem. Many people are obese. In those days, that was the problem. There's a problem. Many people are obese. It's a big problem. And then they went on unrelated news. They said some company is having a recall on their chairs, on their office chairs that are collapsing. And I said, it's not unrelated news. It's the people that are obese are sitting on the chairs. That's why it's collapsing. The Rebbeinu Shem has a connection. I think I haven't said this story in a while. Every once in a while, people come over to me with stories. And most of the time, I can't really use them, but I have to show people that I want the story. So this person came over to me and said, I want to tell you a story about cheesecake. I said, oh, no. I was not in the mood of hearing a story about cheesecake. I was in a rush. But tell me the story. You'll use it. Yeah, I'll use it. And the next time I talk about cheesecake, I'll use it, yeah. So he says, you know, I had a big business deal, a closing. What does that have to do with the cheesecake? Wait, listen to me. Big business deal, a closing, and I didn't know what was going to be by this closing. If I say the right thing and the deal goes through, I could be rich. If not, I could lose everything. He had mortgaged everything on his properties. It was all like a bunch of dominoes, and my stomach was in knots. And the big closing was supposed to be the day after Shavuos. And in the morning, I drove by to pick up my partner, and we're heading to the lawyer's office to negotiate this final closing. It'll either will or won't go through. And I texted to my partner, do me a favor, it's right after Shavuos. Everyone has extra cheesecake left over because today cheesecake comes as Mishlech Manas. We have a new mitzvah of Mishlech Manas for cheesecake. I don't know where that came from exactly. But can you bring me out a piece of cheesecake? And 2 seconds later, his friend comes out with a nice big piece of cheesecake, and they're off. And nothing like when you're nervous cheesecake. That solves the problem, but creates different problems anyway. So all of a sudden his friend goes, oh, you texted me? He goes, well, you didn't see the text? He says, no. So how did you not bring me the cheesecake? Oh, I didn't bring you the cheesecake because of your text. I was about to walk out. And my wife said, you know, he probably didn't have breakfast. Why don't you bring him a piece of cheesecake? She's trying to give me the cheesecake also in the house. So he says, isn't that an amazing story? I texted him to bring me cheesecake. He brought me the cheesecake even before he got the text. I said, yeah, it's an amazing story. I'll put it away someplace. You know, I'll stack it up. I you can use that story. I said, sure. That's a good story. No, you don't get it. I said, I got it. No, he texted me and he bought the cheese. I got it, right. He says to me, you didn't get it. Let me explain it to you. I was losing my patience until I realized he's right, I'm wrong. He said, we do what we do in this world. We send out texts. We ask Hashem. We try to make money. We try to get married. We try to have children. We try. And the Eibishter sends what he sends us. We think because we texted for the cheesecake, we got the cheesecake. Every once in a while, the Kavish Baruch Hu reminds us, you ask for the cheesecake and I'll give it to you, but the two aren't directly connected. I'm going over here and I'm saying, one wrong move and I lose this deal. One right move and I'm rich. Rabbi Hashem already decided whether I get the deal or not. Last Rosh Hashanah was decided what I'm going to get. I have to go to the closing. I have to hire a good lawyer. I have to play the game. Suddenly, I was unbelievably relaxed. I was so relaxed, you can't imagine. B'terem nikru alecha. B'terem nikru alecha. Kadosh Baruch Hu calls out to you. You're going to try to predict the future, where this world is going, where the country is going. The Rebbeinu Shem knows where it's going. It's not our job to predict the future. Our job is to do what we have to. I remember, Rachmana Litzlan, I was sitting shiva for my father. A neighbor came up and he sat down, a very quiet person, never says a word. You know, this good morning, pleasant person, not a very talkative person. And after a while, he says to me, he's just sitting there and we're looking at each other, you know, and he says to me, give me the keys to your car. I said, really? Why? He says, because it's alternate side. In those days, there was something called alternate side, if you remember that. Let me move it for you. And I remember when I walked out, I said, you know, people came and they asked such stupid questions. Oh, your father was sick for a long time? Oh, did he know he's going to die? Are you sure that chair that you're sitting on, does it have the shear? I think it's a little bit too high. Can you please donate money now? It's a schus, you know, it's a big schus. Everyone's giving ideas of how I should have schusim. And he's sitting there, goes, I'm not solving the world's problems. Well, maybe I can move your car for you. You shouldn't get a ticket. Moshe Rabbeinu, right? He gets up, he davens for Miriam. And Moshe Rabbeinu says, Kael na refon Allah. It's not a very long Shemon Esrei, not a very long tefillah. So the Chazal say a fascinating thing. That Moshe was concerned that his detractors are going to say, look at that Moshe Rabbeinu, his sister is suffering. He's davening this long Shemon Esrei. So Moshe said a very short tefillah, Kael na refon Allah. I don't get it. Moshe Rabbeinu should say, you're making fun of me that I'm davening for my sister? You don't chap? What are you? He's davening for his sister. It's like whatever he does is wrong, right? No, I'm going to daven my long Shemon Esrei for my sister. It's not what my Shrevenu does. Okay, so Hashem put me in this situation where ironically, it looks like if I'm davening a long Shemon Esrei, I don't care for my sister. I am davening for my sister. So Kelner Afanala. In other words, Moshe Rabbeinu says, if it was set up this way, is a simon that this is her refuah for me to say Kelner Afanala. If these people are laughing at me, and these people are looking for an excuse to attack me, and they're going to attack me by davening a long Shemoneh Esrei, that's going to show I don't care for my sister, is a simon that Hashem is directing me to say short words, Kelner Afanala, and that's her refuah, not the long Shemoneh Esrei. Imagine if we understood life that way. We looked at all our detractors and all the people that are killing us, the reason we get ulcers, the reason we start fights. You are always accusing me. You're directing me, not accusing me. Moshe Rabbeinu felt he was directed to the Kelner Afanala. Moshe says a fascinating thing. Everybody waited for Miriam to be healed from the tziras. So that shows us the great covenant for Miriam because she was Meister Nefesh Zav. She stood there waiting for Moshe Rabbeinu. So if Miriam would have never gotten tziras, we would have never seen the covenant of Miriam. She would have never said this Lashon Hara. We would have never seen how Hashem appreciates Miriam. Says Ramesha, no. This is Miriam's most difficult moment of her life. It's tziras. She's a Metzora. And Hashem says, I love Klal Yisrael. Hashem says, I love all people. Hashem says, Miriam, I love your schusim. I will never let you down, even in your most difficult moment. That's the covenant of Miriam. Even when we feel like we're a Metzora, Hashem says, you think I don't remember the schusim? Who you are? You're here for me. Don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. So here we are. Right, we're saying goodbye to each other for the summer. Bez Hashem is Baruch Hov. The next time we meet will be in Yerushalayim, Yir HaKadosh, with the Beis Medrash, with the Rosh Yeshiva, with the Megiddush Urim, everyone together. But until then, I was just thinking. So in the last semester, we had remote learning. So on my computer, I saw Theosaurus. If I would have looked for the Theosaurus, I've never figured out how to do it, but I must have pressed the wrong button. It popped up Theosaurus. So I was going to look to say, what does the word remote mean? Because we had remote learning. So distant? No, I don't think we were distant. I think we feel close to each other. We feel for each other. Isolated? I don't think we're isolated. No. Far flung? No, I don't think we're far off. Nah. And one of the words for remote is unlikely, improbable. And I said, that's the word I'm looking for. We had remote learning. It's unlikely that after all we were done, we're still learning together. It's unlikely, it's improbable that after all we went through, we're still not losing our cheshik. We still believe that the Ribono Shel Olam is guiding us. We're still close to each other. We still believe there's the key to the bracha. Yes, this is what the word remote means. May HaKadosh Baruch Hu help as the Shem is Baruch, the next time we see each other. It shouldn't be remote. It shouldn't be virtual. It should be after the hypnosis. It should be L'yoyim Shekulei Shabbos and Menucha L'chayu Elamim. Have a pleasant summer, Rabbi Say. Please stay in touch. And Be'ez Hashem Yisbarach, I hope that we're all zoicha to see each other very, very soon, real time. Kol tov, b'suras tovos.
Right.